Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 5, Hedge Fund Trends and Seed Investments. Steve Terrell and Stephen Giordano will discuss hedge fund trends, co-investment vehicles and issues, and seed investments. Now, on to the podcast.
The first thing I want to talk about today is founders class. Founder class shares has been talked about in an earlier panel. It's not a new trend. It's something that we're continuing to see. Hedge fund managers are looking to raise capital in multiple different ways, one of which is they say, how do we entice our investors to come into the fund early? How do we get them? How do we launch our fund, have a successful launch? How do we start our capital raising off on the right foot? One of the first ways to do it is the founders class. And we talked about enticing the founders with breaks in management fees, incentive allocations. Now, we'll talk about that a little later. Steve will talk about that a little later in his presentation. But we're also seeing that starting to move over into the private equity fund space. Typically in the private equity fund space, you have that with free breaks and side letters, et cetera. But some of our private equity funds are also inserting the founders classes into their fund documents in order to show investors that there is a benefit to coming in early. We typically see standalone funds with emerging managers. Emerging managers are coming out. They may not have the capacity to launch a full master feeder structure. They typically are going to their soft circling with their friends and their families, and we're looking at usually Delaware limited partnerships. And with the idea that as the strategy takes off, as their fundraising gets better, more investors will be enticed to invest, and that's when we'll sort of move over into a structure for the master feeder where you have the offshore investors participating in the structure. We're also looking at established managers that may want to launch a new strategy. They may not have the capital demand from outside investors, so they'll put their internal capital to work. And they obviously want to do it in a cost-efficient manner. The way to do that is obviously with a standalone fund, with the idea of obviously launching it to outside investors at a later date. Another way to investors are continuing to look at the bringing in capital is through seed deals. Now, over the last year or so, or even more, we've seen a reduced activity with seed deals, and that's probably because hedge fund returns are down, as I mentioned before, and also because less managers with pedigrees are coming out. And so one thing leads to another, and we have less activity on that side. But again, Steve is going to be talking about that a little bit, some of the seed terms, things to think about, how to entice investors to come in through seed deals later in his presentation. What I've been seeing also a hedge fund trend over the last few years is a migration to private equity. This has been due in part because there's been less opportunity on the liquid side. So what we've seen is, at least with managers that I've been working with, is as they continue to see more opportunities on the less liquid side, they move further into the less liquid side. And they, as they look at their fund terms to accommodate those liquid, illiquid positions, they realize that their terms may not be able to accommodate those types of investments. The first thing I'll say is, they'll say, well, you know, we want to invest in X, Y, and Z over here, Steve. How can we accommodate those in our fund documents? Well, the fund terms have to match sort of the liquidity of the underlying investment, in which case the manager has two things they need to think about. They either will look to change their fund terms a little bit to accommodate the less liquid investments, including addition of side pockets, gates, holdbacks, et cetera, or they'll move into another vehicle. Typically, they could start with co-investment vehicles or one-off investments, single investment funds, things like that. I'm going to skip over crossover hedge funds here for a second. Talk a little bit about co-investment vehicles. As for the evolution of managers from hedge funds to private equity fund type deals, what I've seen is less over the last few years, what I've seen less is managers going back into their fund terms and trying to modify those terms, because there is this sort of hangover from side pockets and investors sort of frowning on side pockets. So what I've seen lately is more people moving into, more managers moving into the co-investment vehicles, where they have a better sense and a better feel to start the funds with the terms that will match the underlying liquidity of the investments. It's a way that a manager can start to differentiate themselves, create a track record on the illiquid side, and offer alpha to their investors in a way that's separate and apart from their hedge fund. It also is a way to bring in new AUM. It could complement their existing liquid strategy depending upon the sectors that they're looking at, and is a way for them to continue to move the business in a direction where the market is going at the time. The co-investment policy, the thing to think about with a co-investment is typically hedge fund managers that start out without a co-investment vehicle or co-investment opportunities, the one thing to think about is, does the manager have a policy with respect to co-investments? And most of them haven't that I've worked with. And so before they start down the path of following and looking into co-investment and launching co-investment funds, we talked about a co-investment policy and how that might make sense for their business and for their strategy and for their investors. With the migration to private equity, the SEC has been very concerned about how managers are treating co-investment opportunities and looking to not only the fund documents to see how co-investment opportunities are allocated to the investors, but also to the actual co-investment policy, whether it's thought out, whether the manager is following the co-investment policy, and how consistent they are in the application of that. One of the things that we talk about typically when we're working with a manager on co-investments is the first thing is, how do we price these? And it really depends on the reason that the manager is launching the co-investment fund in the first place. If the investment is an addition to the fund and it is additive to the fund's portfolio, then perhaps the manager prices at a lower fee. There may or may not be a management fee. More likely than not, for investors that are in the fund and also in the co-investment fund, there may not be a management fee. The incentive tends to be lower, maybe over a preferred return. But for investments that are separate and apart from the fund, maybe not be additive to the portfolio, where the manager is looking to generate alpha, what we see is more private equity-like with management fees, maybe higher management fees with a distribution waterfall, et cetera, that with a 15 or a 20%, maybe even over hurdle. But those tend to be higher than the opportunities that are priced for investments that are additive to the portfolio. One thing I wanted to go back and talk about a little bit is crossover hedge funds. And I wanted to work backwards because crossover hedge funds, I think, are not necessarily a trend that we're seeing in the market, but we are seeing these types of funds more and more in the niche spaces. So, for example, we may see them on the biotech side where managers feel that they are doing the due diligence on the private side that's additive to a portfolio on the liquid side. So they'll create a fund where it's both hedge and private equity. The benefit of having a liquid portfolio and an illiquid portfolio, for example, is if a manager wants to spend all sorts of time looking into a particular company, doing the due diligence, following that company, they really believe in the manager. In a typical private equity fund, if the company were to go public, that's at the point where they have a realization, they distribute the shares, or they realize on the investment, bring the cash out to the investors. With a crossover hedge fund, if they really have a great comfort with the company, with the management, they want to hold on to it, they can actually take the company out of the illiquid side and put it into the public side or the more liquid side. That way they can hold on to the company for longer, they can be real partners with the company, and it works, it's a sort of a synergy between not only within the fund itself, but also with the manager as they work to partner with the executives and the management team of the company, which they've spent a considerable amount of time with. One thing to think about with crossover hedge funds, it's really a bespoke product. The terms aren't necessarily something that there is a market for. It really depends on the type of assets that the manager is seeking to identify. It's also something that, let me back up here. There's really not a market term here. So we work closely with our managers to identify the type of assets that they're looking for, the type of companies that they're investing in, how that complements their liquid strategy. One thing to think about, though, is when you have two separate sides, you have a liquid portfolio and an illiquid portfolio, is how the fees and the expenses are going to be allocated to both sides of the illiquid and the liquid portfolio. For example, when you have an incentive that you're taking on the illiquid side versus the illiquid side, is that something that you're going to net out together? Or are you going to keep them separate? That's one thing to think about there. Last thing I want to talk about here is regulatory trends on the expenses. It's obviously something that's been out there a couple, two, 3 years, where the SEC has been very focused on expenses. We work both on the investor side and the sponsor side. I see fund documents mirroring sort of the SEC's concern on this. There's been more transparency on the both on the hedge fund side and the private equity side, more and better disclosure in terms of expenses and fees. That's carried over not only on the private equity side because of some of the recent enforcement actions that we've seen over the last few years, it's now bringing itself into the hedge fund world, which is better for investors and for managers as well as the business continues to evolve and they get more complicated as they move from sort of the illiquid, just working with liquid companies and liquid assets to both liquid and illiquid assets. Steve?
Terrific. Well, my name's Steve Giordano. I'm from the Boston office. Today I'm going to talk about seed deals, and again, seed deals are not something that's a new trend in the market, and something that we've continually have seen, and it's evolving in the market. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about both the seed deals from the manager perspective and seed deals from the seeder perspective. And you'll see when you line these to two sides up, there's alignments of interest galore in there, but there's also conflicts that come about. The main reason from the seed capital perspective of why they like the seed deals is the extended piece of revenue. This allows a seeder to continue to create a revenue source from an asset class that they're very interested in. In addition to that long-term benefit, they're going to get additional forms of return on their invested capital, which comes in the form of this early stage premium of investing in emerging managers. Many emerging managers produce their best returns in the first 2 or 3 years, which is generally the period of time when the large institutions are watching them before they make their large investment. They're also able to negotiate significantly better terms on fees, transparency, capacity. They participate through the rev share and the asset growth of the manager. And what is now more prevalent is the monetization event of the management companies. You know, 5-7 years ago, we weren't talking about that exit per se, but now there is a market where firms are going out buying equity stakes in more established managers. And if the seed investment proves out to be a good prospect, then they could be a candidate for one of these buyout companies. From an underlying manager perspective, it's real simple. They need capital. So if you have a manager with pedigree coming out, in order to make a splash in the market, you know, the $50 million launches aren't going to move the needle too much. Managers want to hit the market with a $100 million to $200 million mark. The seed capital is usually the fastest way to get there. So that's the number one reason for it. The other one is, obviously, is fundraising is difficult. How can we get the money? How can we prove ourselves quickly? So managers are willing to balance the needs of the terms that they're going to have to take on with the seed investor in order to get the capital. In addition, the regulation, which lawyers love, is causing a higher barrier to entry for the managers to launch their products. And ongoing, the compliance component and the depth of the team you need to maintain a good compliance program and a good business practice within the organization is expensive. So having that critical mass is important to them. In addition, there are some other benefits the managers have, and I'll point out a few, is the stamp of approval. Once you have a large institutional seeder behind you, it puts you on the map and others will take notice. It allows you to build out a more experienced team, larger back office, hopefully tapping into the network of the seeders investor base. And seeders are coming in all shapes and sizes today. It's not just the traditional seeders. You're going to see them in the, what I'll call the strategic seeders, very well-established hedge fund firms themselves that want to attract additional talent of like minds for their strategy to share ideas. You're going to see firms, very large firms that we all know as traditional hedge fund managers, seeding. You also see newer family offices or other wealthier individuals or organizations looking to get into this market because of the earlier benefits. Some of the drawbacks we'll talk about when we get to the more important slide near the end of the terms. But the drawbacks of using seed capital is, for a manager starting out, it's time-consuming and very expensive process if you're going to do it right. There's a huge economic impact if that seeder withdraws from your fund prematurely. So there's a risk early on that if that seeder uses its rights to get out early, what that means for the manager long-term. On the flip side, the seeders, if it's successful seed, will whittle down their investments over time and almost get themselves fully withdrawn from the fund maybe after 5, 6, 7 years, and will retain, if they have a perpetual revenue share in the fund. The seed investor may insist on very restrictive covenants around how the manager runs their business and how they manage their portfolio. And then there's negative tax consequences to the manager. And this is one we'll talk about a little bit more at length, because seeders are getting, I think, smarter about the tax consequences. For managers to satisfy those needs, may be swapping what I'll call good income for bad income to benefit the seeder. But before we get into the seed terms, this is part of the trend that we're seeing in the form of seeding. And you're going to see what we'll term acceleration capital. And that's usually, we refer to that as capital coming in for a manager with an infrastructure in place that has been running 3, 4, 5 years, but hasn't hit that critical mass yet. And you'll see managers put themselves out there looking for that capital to get to the next level. The other one is founder shares, which I think was talked about earlier in one of the panels. And that's one where you generally see fee discounts and you're incenting investors to come in early for this benefit.
On that earlier panel, Steve, I think they were talked about having a rev share component attached to the founder shares. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's a great point. And I think it was touched on earlier. We're starting to see, and this is probably the biggest trend that we'll see on the founders class, is managers using that founders class not only for a fee discount, but to also offer a portion of the rev share. And it's usually in the form of a gross rev share. The benefit for the manager of doing this is some of those, the detriments or disadvantages of a seed deal is that they can set the terms on what rev share they want to give up. They can set the terms on what restrictions they want to place on themselves. And as you can imagine, a lot of managers won't put the heavy restrictions on them, such as a non-solicit of their own investors or people, a non-compete on themselves if things don't work out. And it's much more efficient to implement one of these structures. So we're seeing that crossover of my putting together a rev share with a founders class. When we look at starting a seed deal, there's two general forms of it, and there's a hybrid in between. One is just a straight gross rev share. One is a net equity deal. And the third option, which is in between, is a modified net deal. The equity deals are less common today, and for a whole host of reasons. Seeders get heavily involved in the manager from an ownership perspective, which may not only bring the tax consequences that are difficult to navigate, but also regulatory issues. If they own more than 25% of the manager, they're going to be included on the ADV. In some of our seeding scenarios, some of those seeders have the managers housed in their own organizations, which could draw in regulatory compliance issues from an SEC exam. How separate are the organizations? So we're seeing more of the rev share components, and these rev share deals are really just straight off the top types of revenue. They range from 10 to 40%. 40% is on the high end. You may see that with private equity firms who play in this space. The 10% are really around the founder share class kind of rev share structure to family offices. I think the norm you're going to see is anywhere from 20 to 30%, and that will vacillate based on the terms that the seeder gets and certain benchmarks of asset growth and revenue growth. What we're seeing now is the first piece being longer lockup periods. Obviously, a seeder is going to come in, make an investment. That money is going to be locked up subject to withdrawal rights. And it's really these early triggers that are heavily negotiated. And you're going to see certain drawdown rights, fund performance, redemptions, and just return bogeys that aren't satisfied during a period of time, which can trigger an early withdrawal from the seed deal. Usually, though, that comes along with a reduction or elimination of the rev share or equity component if they have to trigger these rights early. Another piece that is heavily negotiated is the fees that the seeder and others will pay. I think Goldman might have mentioned in the earlier panel too that watch out for the double dip. Well, here's where it can happen. The seeder can come in as asking for 20-30% of whatever the revs are from a gross or net perspective, but may also seek no fees on its own money or a reduced fee in its class. I think from my perspective, the norm in the market is the seeder pays the full fee, even if you're offering a founder's class at the same time, the seeder will pay the full, but will get its rev share on all components. Control. The control over the budget and the governance is most prevalent in an equity deal. And these are the points where you'll get heavy, heavy negotiation because the manager and the seeder are sharing the fees on a net basis. And there, your budget, what you have for expenses, bonuses, capital expansion, leases, are all negotiated items where that seeder will be heavily involved. The buyout rights, this is one we're seeing a trend where 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was a perpetual revenue share. So if the seeder withdrew his money, even after the lockup period, they would retain these rights going forward. Now we're seeing sunset provisions, and these sunset provisions can be as short as 5 years, I've seen in the market, as long as 20, although in my mind 20 is really an eternity for a fund manager. So I think that the market's gonna balance around 7 to 10 years on those buyout terms. And the buyout terms can be a gross fair market value calculation. It could be a tail fee based on certain revenues over a period of time. It could be a multiple of revenue earned over a 2-3 year period, tied also to a multiple of assets in the fund. But there's different metrics and different multiples that seeders are putting out there. And to say there's a market term, which we're asked that quite often, I have to say there's actually not a market term because the different seeders have their own views on this one. What you don't see too many of those, the fair market value deals. The next big piece is the MFN treatment, enhanced reporting, reserve capacity rights. These are all the types of enhancement to the returns that a seeder seeks. The MFN will give better rights going forward after a certain period of time so that if the manager is going to offer different classes at different fee breaks, they're going to get the benefit of those rights. I think the prior panel talked about enhanced reporting and that with the conflicts that come along with that, as well as reserve capacity rights and co-investment rights. And as Steve mentioned in his presentation, co-investments are a very important additional form of revenue enhancement for a seed investor. So they use the seed platform as an opportunity to get themselves into those co-investment deals, which can be very lucrative, not only for the seeder, but also for other investors in the fund. So it's a win-win across the board. The last one I want to touch on, the last two, I know we're running on time, is the non-compete, non-solicit. Seeders, in order to protect their rights, will ask for non-solicit. When you see the non-solicits going for 5 years, I think that's extremely long in the market and may not be enforceable in many states. And they're using the 5 years because that's what you may see in an M&A type of transaction when you're buying a company. More realistically, I think it's 18 months to 24 months with proper carve-outs to allow the manager to continue to earn a living if the seed arrangement doesn't work out. And the last point I just want to touch on, because I have an affinity for taxes and the tax structuring, but I won't bore you with that today, is the seed deals and how they look to structure. The seeders generally don't want to earn unrelated business taxable income or effectively connected income. So they're going to try to avoid getting direct payments on a management fee because of the taint of a management fee being service type income. And that could, if the seeder is coming through with an offshore vehicle, constitute effectively connected income. So they may ask for a rollover or a conversion of that management fee into the form of a special profit allocation. There's ways in which that can be done. We've done many different forms of it, but one parting point I'll make on this is seeders are asking for the priority on the good income, the capital gain income, and they're using that leverage to put money into a manager's fund to get launched. Managers feel pressure to accept to give up more of their good income, that is the long-term capital gain income, and taking more of the management fee income for themselves. And that's the swap I mentioned earlier, where these managers are being asked to take more ordinary income, which has higher tax rates, and maybe the tax rates will change with the Trump administration, but we're not sure. And the seed are looking to benefit and maximize their capital gain component. And that's one where we find heavy negotiations. So with that, I'd like to conclude and say thank you for all coming and really appreciate the support.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.